Good evening, friends. Franz Weinschenk here. That's right. It's 7 o'clock on a Wednesday evening, and like on every Wednesday evening about this time, it's my real pleasure to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, a program where authors from right here in the Central Valley get to read their stories. Tonight we welcome Fresno author Michael Lee Bowler, whose story is about, of all people, lawyers. The name of his story is Dump Truck, which you'll have to admit is a very unusual title for a story about things having to do with justice and the law. Well, let's find out. Here's Hal Boland to read Michael Lee Bowler's story, Dump Truck.
Dump Truck, An Existential Journey. Bill Burke for the defense. We acknowledge receipt of the misdemeanor complaint, waive formal reading and advisement of constitutional and statutory rights, and that day in Department 17, Bill Burke had repeated those lines at least 15 times, and by his calculations, 710 times during his 4 months with the Fresno County Public Defender's Office. But it goes on. Enter a plea of not guilty to all counts. That didn't complete his courtroom spiel, but it was enough to understand why he had begun to feel like a lawyer action figure with a string emerging from its back, which, when pulled, causes the figure to produce repetitive words from its mouth. He thought there could be a collectible series of them, courtroom action figures consisting of poorly dressed defense lawyer, rigid prosecutor, nervous clerk, brittle court reporter, pretentious judge, and, of course, frightened client. When asked why he left Anaheim at age 50 and ended up in Fresno, his usual reply was, "I sobered up." The real answer was more complex. He went to law school to become a public defender, a real criminal defense lawyer. But reality got in the way, a family to support and children to raise. And after 27 years of semi-marital bliss, she left. Of course, the death of a marriage takes time. It just quietly and slowly creeps up on you. At first, repetition sets in. Husband and wife both know what roles to play day after day. Both trudged off to work every morning. In the evening, they return home. She to talk to their three children, he to work in his garage. After the children left, and she no longer had anyone to care for or even to talk to, she announced, "We live separately together. We might as well live separately." The next morning, she was gone. She hired a lawyer. He hired a lawyer. She filed for divorce. He responded. They split the property and sold the house. He wanted his huge new truck and his motorcycle, so she got the Mercedes. Children were informed, and Burke pretty much stayed drunk for the next 4.5 months. His law partners called and said either he should sober up or they would buy him out. He sold. Business and contract law no longer meant anything besides making money, and he had already done that. No matter how much money he made, they had always needed more. Without his family, he no longer needed to do that. In college, when a motorcycle was his means of transport, he didn't want to go to law school to make outrageous sums of money. He wanted to be a famous trial lawyer who freed wrongfully accused murderers and the underrepresented. But when he started law school, he bought a bigger motorcycle, and his student loans mounted. Maybe he'd defend white-collar criminals so he could pay down his student loans and buy yet a bigger motorcycle. After law school, two realizations came to him. One, most criminals are criminals because they're poor. And two, white-collar criminals and big-time drug dealers usually have their money seized by the government and they can't afford to hire a lawyer. Well, maybe defending insurance companies and writing contracts and helping housing developers get past zoning laws wasn't a bad way to make a buck. He decided he would shuffle an occasional criminal case into the mix. But he didn't have time to shuffle. He got married. She always seemed to want a bigger house, and the children needed braces, and prep school had to be paid for. Country club dues had to be kept up so that he would have a place to take clients. It seemed somebody always needed something he and his wife had to pay for by working at separate jobs at separate places to make a joint income. Since she left, none of that seemed to matter. He could sit back and take a deep breath, grow his hair long, and just say, "Who cares?" And then he thought, practice criminal defense law. It didn't hurt that he had money from the old law firm and money from selling the house. Not enough, though, to live on for long, because nothing can eat up assets quicker than a divorce and a divorce lawyer. That's when a friend from law school, who heard from another friend that Burke wanted to practice criminal law, and told yet a third friend, whose friend said that he had heard that the Fresno County Public Defender was looking for lawyers. Didn't pay much to start, and he would have to live in Fresno. He would, however, get to practice criminal law. And he did have enough money that he could buy a house, a bigger motorcycle, and have savings left over to supplement a modest income and not have to live how he surmised public defenders lived. So he sent off his resume and a letter. He wrote that he wanted to practice criminal defense law, and he'd heard Fresno had lots of criminals. 3 days later, he received a phone call. Could he come in for an interview? The interview with public defender Carlos Carl Romero went something like this. "You want to be a defense attorney here? You live in Fresno? Okay, then. Everyone starts at the bottom. You'll start at around $50,000 a year, but after 7 or 8 years, if you stay and if you come to work sober every day and are competent at what you do, you'll be making a little over $100,000. If you go into management, you'll make a little more. Can you start next week?" And, "I like shoes shined and hair cut. Get your hair cut. Just because you're a public defender doesn't mean you have to look like one." Burke didn't so much want to look like a public defender, but he wanted to feel what in the 60s he thought a public defender would feel like while defending the downtrodden and being an all-around martyr and saving the world from the Vietnam War racism and the excesses of unrestrained capitalism. Narcissism runs deep in children of the 60s. And that's how Bill Burke went from being a big-city successful partner in an even more successful law firm making middle six figures to a modestly paid public defender who says the same thing over and over again to judges who don't seem to care and who works against deputy district attorneys who all seem to look and act like high school hall monitors. He thought the only downside was that he'd have to live in Fresno. It had such a bad reputation as a hot, dusty, agricultural hole. Maybe it was the nasal-sounding name Fresno that caused people from other places to snidely snicker. Or maybe the bad press came from an old Carol Burnett television satire called Fresno. It became apparent when he arrived in Fresno that criticism came from people who had never been to Fresno. Except for geography, most American cities are pretty much the same. They all have identical shopping centers, the same tract houses, freeways clogged with the same cars, and tired citizens who always have more they have to do than time to do it in. After he arrived, he learned that he had to spend time in what is affectionately called misdemeanor land, a place filled with drunk drivers, illegal aliens without driver's licenses, teenage girl shoplifters, adult petty thieves, husbands who shove their wives, wives who slap their husbands, and 19-year-old boyfriends who slept with their 17-year-old girlfriends, much to their born-again parents' disapproval. In short, regular folk, most without money, or who had parents who have money but refused to bail them out again, who had the misfortune of getting caught performing an everyday criminal act. And because of them, Burke had a job where he said the same thing over and over, every day. Perpetual repetitiveness, just like his marriage. He arraigned his last client and said not guilty again and left for the day. Another day in misdemeanor land. Meet him, greet him, and plead him. Unless he actually could get someone to agree to go to trial. He didn't feel like a public defender. He still felt like a contract lawyer with too much nobleness and not enough oblige. Maybe during the next staff meeting someone would tell him what being a public defender felt like. Some 30 people filled the public defender's conference room during their periodic staff meetings of investigators, lawyers, office assistants, secretaries, and receptionists. And of course, the office had well over 100 employees, but they were cast about offices throughout Fresno County, offices for juvenile lawyers, for courts out in the small towns. Most didn't come. And those who did come were the same 30 people at every meeting. Carl Romero emceed the meeting. He didn't dress like a public defender. He was what used to be called a a slick dresser. Tightly tailored clothing, shiny Italian loafers, pastel shirts, and silk ties. He looked more like an Italian Ferrari dealer than a lawyer, let alone a public defender. "First, folks, I'd like to introduce our newest lawyer," he said. "Bill Burke. He's part of our new youth movement," he added. Polite laughter followed. "He's going to be working in our misdemeanor department." Talk then shifted to a particular judge, someone who would turn out to be Burke's full-time judge. "She told me," said one attorney sitting at the edge of the room, "we try too many cases. I guess she thinks we ought to be dump trucks." Dump truck meant a public defender who pleaded all his clients guilty and refused to go to trial. But Boyle, who was Burke's supervisor in misdemeanor land, wanted to make it clear. "My attorneys aren't dump trucks. We go to trial." Burke thought Boyle stood up when he said this, but because Boyle was short, it was very difficult to tell if Boyle was sitting or standing. When Burke began to practice law, he noticed trial attorneys had a tendency to be short. Among trial attorneys, anyone over 5'11 stands out as unusually tall. Someone over 6'2 is a giant. Burke was 5'10. "Doesn't it depend on how one defines dump truck?" asked Larry C. Lessman. "Now, doesn't it stand to reason that if one settles a case with good resolution, better than one could receive at a trial, he's not acting as a dump truck? But if one settles the case for what one could get at trial just to avoid trial, one is a dump truck?" Didn't matter what Lessman said. He always sounded like a junior high school teacher explaining things to a class of special needs students. He was oblivious to how other people reacted to being treated that way. For him, everything was an intellectual process, which, it turned out, actually helped him as a criminal defense lawyer. When he defended someone who was looking at spending the rest of his life in prison, it was just a puzzle Lessman had to figure out. If someone actually went to prison for the rest of their life, it was just another unresolved riddle. The client was irrelevant. "Dump truck or no dump truck," said Carl Romero, "Lessman here just proved them wrong. He got an acquittal in a lifetime case." Those paying attention applauded. Lessman didn't seem impressed that his client could have spent his entire life in prison and had depended on Lessman to make that not happen. Another attorney, Jorge Sanchez, interrupted the mild applause with, "Yeah, but did he get it to be on television, in the newspapers?" He said this with his self-deprecating humor. Everyone knew the most dangerous place to be in Fresno was between a television camera and Sanchez. In his mind, he was the greatest criminal defense lawyer in Fresno, maybe California. He knew everyone knew he thought that and made an occasional joke about it. This was one of those occasions. Everyone also knew that he wasn't all that far off, and that he and Lessman were considered two of the best criminal defense attorneys in Fresno. Sanchez was surprisingly tall, just under 5'9". He dressed like a cross-cultural icon. He bought his clothes at a local clothier specializing in mock Brooks Brothers English-cut suits, and then he took them to an Italian tailor to have them fitted. He did it with every stitch he owned: blazers, khaki pants, madras shirts, even broadcloth button-down shirts. It didn't matter. Everything was both a little too tight for what a proper British gentleman would wear and too British for a French one. "I'm sure most of you have heard of the White Murder," Romero said, taking back the center of attention. "A leader of the inspirational evangelical church and his homosexual lover allegedly murdered the minister's wife. You know, the one where they found the body under the recently built portion of the church's parking lot? It's going to be a capital case. And Sanchez has the gay lover. There should be loads of press on it, and we all know how Sanchez hates the media. Maybe this guy won't attack him like the last guy did." "Hey," said Sanchez, "if a client doesn't attack you once in a while, you're not doing your job as a public defender. Besides, after he punched me, he was acquitted and apologized, but I'll try to stay away from the cameras." Lessman just stared at Romero, looking surprised. He had wanted the white case. But divvying up the sexy cases was something Carl Romero did with awe-inspiring political skill. He knew which attorneys wanted which cases bad enough to cater to him. Right now, Sanchez was favored. The two were part of the same golf foursome, went to the same AA meetings, and frequented the same cigar store where they had a source for Cubans. They also both spoke Spanish, which they would occasionally slip into when they had a compadre moment. Because Lessman didn't speak Spanish, wasn't a drunk, didn't play golf, and couldn't relate to anyone as a compadre or even a drinking buddy, he was at a real disadvantage when it came to getting the good cases. Nobody seemed to Burke to act, look, or even feel like what he had expected from public defenders. They seemed just as though they were lawyers who, like most lawyers, wanted to go to trial and wished they were paid more. If they became famous along the way, so much the better. Even Maria Ramirez, who sat next to Sanchez and who didn't care about press or recognition, got better cases than Lessman. She was short, somewhat squat, with dark brown skin and very Indian features, and grew up in a dusty Central Valley town where her illegal father cut grapes off vines and picked garlic under a baking sun. When school was out, she and her eight brothers and sisters had also worked in the fields. Now, her three brothers were dead, one from drinking, one killed by a drunk driver, and one shot. All her sisters still lived in the same town with farm worker husbands and children caught between two cultures. Some of the children chose street gangs, Bulldogs, Serenos, Nortinos, and were either in prison or on their way. She, though, made her way through UCLA undergrad and USC law school. In her family, she was not just a star, but the star. Ramirez was in the middle of an attorney rape case that had garnered press. A 25-year-old farm worker who was charged with kidnapping and raping a 14-year-old girl who had come to Fresno to live with an aunt who had, in turn, come to the U.S. some 20 years earlier. Neither the defendant nor the girl spoke English, and when they met, they were both working in the fields. He looked at her. She returned his gaze with a smile. Later, they spoke during a water break, and they learned that they were both born in the same town, and the same coyote smuggled them across the border and on up to Fresno. They met every day during the water breaks for 2 weeks. And then, together, they disappeared. A week after they vanished, her aunt, unaware of their plan, called the police. The lovers were apprehended just north of Merced, where they were working in the fields. He was sent to jail, and she back to her aunt. The cops decided she was kidnapped because the couple was last seen leaving the fields, he pulling her into a car owned by his cousin, and it was assumed that a 14-year-old girl wouldn't leave voluntarily with a 25-year-old man. Maria, whose grandparents met the same way and locked into a 62-year marriage, knew what was going on. It wasn't a clash of sexes, but a clash of cultures. In small Mexican towns, this was how things were done. He smiled at her, she at him, and he kidnapped her. To white people, Ramirez said just before the meeting adjourned, anybody who doesn't do things their way is a criminal and is looking at prison and maybe deportation. But I'm giving closing argument today, if anyone wants to watch. Burke, who had never seen a closing anywhere but on television dramas, wanted to see a short, chubby, 30-year-old Mexican woman convince a jury that a 25-year-old man had every right to pull a 14-year-old girl out of the fields, push her into a car, and drive off with her. He entered the courtroom during Ramirez's final argument and sat in the gallery. He was the only person in the courtroom save court personnel and one reporter. The jury consisted of 9 white women and 3 white men, all of whom stared blankly at Ramirez. Burke later learned about the difficulties of getting people of color on a jury because juries were drawn from voting rolls and driver's license lists. Most Central Valley Hispanics either couldn't vote because they weren't citizens, or if they were citizens, they couldn't afford a car or registration fees, or even if they could get a license, it probably was jerked because they couldn't pay for a ticket or two. Many black men were felons and couldn't sit on a jury even if they could get a license. It seemed only white people could vote, afford to pay the various fees to keep driver's licenses, and weren't felons. The judge, like most judges, was a former deputy district attorney. He sat up on the bench trying to look stone-faced, but looking more like constipated old gray-haired white guy who thought everyone in the courtroom was guilty of something. Governors appoint judges, Burke reasoned to himself. Governors know that those who appear soft on crime lose elections, and nobody could say a former deputy district attorney is weak on crime. While Ramirez was giving her closing argument, the prosecutor sat straight up, like a teacher's pet getting ready to be told he had received the best grade in the class. He was dressed in his best dark suit and stiffly ironed white shirt and had his open laptop computer placed on his obsessively, compulsively neat prosecution table. 63 years ago, said Ramirez, in a little Mexican village called Santa Maria de la Paz, my grandfather kidnapped my grandmother. They were promenading around the village square, the men going clockwise, the women counterclockwise. Their eyes met. He smiled at her, and she at him. And the future was set, as she told me many years later. Of course, they had known of each other before, and whenever they had had an encounter, she would modestly look away, but not this time. That night, she left her bedroom light burning. She knew he was hiding nearby in a bush. He saw the light, snuck up to her curtained window, crawled in, and whisked her away. She, to protect her honor, made a symbolic objection and feigned struggle, but they both knew that they were as good as married. Several years later, they entered this country where my mother was born, as I was. It's hard for us to understand my grandmother did not consider herself the victim of a kidnapping. It's hard for us to understand, she said, while walking behind her client and placing her hand on his shoulder, that Manuel here did not believe himself to be a kidnapper. He had entered this great country looking for a life of prosperity and freedom, and what he found was fields where he worked in 110-degree heat cutting grapes. But he found her, and she found him. Their eyes met, they smiled, and their future was set. And there's another thing. The prosecutor would have you believe she's 14 and he's 25 based on relatives' testimony. Those relatives weren't there when she was born, and they're going mainly on beliefs and traditions. We didn't see birth certificates or certified records. How old are they? We don't know. That's reasonable doubt. We heard both these lovers testify no one was kidnapped, and she didn't know when she was born. That's reasonable doubt. There's no statutory rape here. Come on, folks. We all know better. There's no kidnapping or rape here. Just two lovers going into marriage. Burke later learned juries believed defendants were guilty of something, otherwise they wouldn't have been arrested. Defense attorneys had better be ready to prove innocence or give the jury some other reason to acquit. The prosecutor gave his final argument. One thing that irked Burke was that the prosecutor gives the first so-called final argument, then the defense makes their final argument, and the prosecutor is given yet another chance to sell his case to the jury. That's the way the system was set up. Burke decided if some legislator or judge could think of a way to let the prosecutor get a conviction, that's how the rules got written. He decided something else. Prosecutors are lousy speakers. Burke heard the prosecutor stiffly deliver a pedantic, linear argument from behind the podium. Somebody saw the defendant pull the victim into the car. The victim was underage, therefore the defendant is guilty. Next, Burke and the jury had to sit through an excruciatingly long laundry list of jury instructions. The lawyers had fought several hours in the judge's chambers over each word of each instruction. Burke could see the jurors squirm and twist. Two of them yawned in sequence and their eyes glazed over as though they were thinking, "Why is this judge putting us through this? This is really boring. They never show this on television. If I had known this, I would have figured out some way to get out of jury duty. It's nearly noon and I'm hungry." To Burke, it became obvious that the instructions would be trashed in the jury room. He doubted the lawyers or the judge fully understood them, let alone 12 bored, hungry jurors. Maybe Ramirez felt like a public defender. But Burke didn't think she was quite 60s enough to fulfill the role. She seemed to be a person who just wanted to do the best she could at her job. Burke knew he wanted to do trials. "How," he asked Lessman, Sanchez, and a few of the other attorneys in their sandwich shop lunch, "how do you get a client to go to trial?" Lessman, of course, had a convoluted answer full of more questions than answers. "It depends on the case and the client. Tell the client you think that he might win a trial, but then again he might lose. Or he may get a hung jury when all the jurors can't agree on a verdict, in which case the district attorney may want to bring the case again, or maybe not." Well, this made no sense at all. He might win, or he might lose, or he might get a hung jury. This will get a client to want to take a chance on trial? It did, though, seem to work for Lessman. He went to trial a lot, and he won a lot. But he also lost a lot, and he had a few hung juries. "Just explain your options to the client," said Sanchez. "If he says he's innocent, tell him he ought to go to trial." Burke, though, realized it was really up to the deputy district attorney. If the DDA said the client should plead to running a stop sign instead of driving under the influence, the case would settle before trial. Most DDAs could give dozens of reasons why a case should settle. His favorite was when one DDA said, "I've lost interest in the case," and dismissed it. Also, judges wanted cases to settle. They didn't want to sit through 4 days of trial to decide which of two brothers was the aggressor in their fist fight. "I'll tell you what, counsel," a judge would say, If one of the brothers pleads, he won't go to jail or be fined. But if neither pleads, one will go to jail after he's convicted. No one wants to go to jail, so somebody would plead to a misdemeanor with the understanding that if he were not arrested again for 6 months, the case would be dismissed. Not being a dump truck was harder than it sounded. There were plenty of clients in misdemeanor land. At arraignment, especially if they were out of custody, they would say something like, "Hey, I ain't taking nothing, man. I'm taking this to the box. They'll never convict me. I didn't do nothing." So the defense attorney would work the case up for trial, order investigations, locate witnesses, collect evidence, make lists of facts and notes of questions, draft jury instructions, practice their arguments, and a myriad of other tasks. And at any point along the way, the client could change his mind and plead guilty, and most did. Burke learned that as trial day crept up, clients would begin to soften. Burke would tell his client, usually a man, the potential punishment for taking a deal and pleading guilty to a misdemeanor before trial. Usually it would be a few days of working for the county, picking up trash near a freeway, and a couple of years of being good on probation. But, Burke would warn, judges tended to hit defendants hard who lost at trial, often with jail time. The client would weigh his option and usually opt to spend 4 days picking up trash under government supervision. Or, of course, he would tell his parents or wife that the dump truck public defender made him take the deal and that he was really innocent. His folks would energetically agree. No one wanted a criminal for a kid or a husband. The result was that after nearly 4 months, Burke still had not gone to trial. 2 hours after lunch, Burke was between arraignments in Department 17 when the courtroom clerk told him Maria Ramirez's jury was back. News traveled among court clerks as fast as electricity through water. A single fractal of data hits one clerk, and it seems simultaneously every clerk in the courthouse had the skinny. The clerk said the verdict was mixed. Not guilty to kidnapping, but guilty of sex with a minor as a misdemeanor. The county district attorney in his next election would call it a conviction. He wouldn't bother to tell the electorate that sex with a minor was a misdemeanor and that Manuel was sentenced to 180 days in jail, then placed on probation, and would not need to register as a sex offender. But it was a definite win for Ramirez. Burke thought maybe Ramirez does know what it feels like to be a public defender. Everyone said Ramirez lost, except the other public defenders. He got back to his arraignments. This time he was appointed to represent a tall, angry-looking white man in his 40s, whose prison tattoos covered his arms and neck and disappeared into his short-sleeved jail jumpsuit. The tats looked like a series of bad French impressionist paintings, all blurry blue-gray, with the subjects just vaguely identifiable. They were obviously done in prison by untrained hands. The client was charged with pushing his wife around, and his parole would most likely be violated. He was going back to prison no matter what happened. And the defendant enters a plea of, as Burke was reciting the arraignment spiel, his client suddenly lunged toward him, rammed the top of his head into Burke's ribs, and shoved him to the floor. Even though the inmate's hands were shackled in front of him, he was able to grab Burke by his shirt and headbutt him. "You dump truck," Burke's client called. "You're not fighting for me. You don't care about me," he shouted, while slamming his forehead into Burke's face. The bailiff jumped into action, pulling the prisoner upright. Burke stood up, brushed back his hair, tightened his tie, and continued, "We enter a plea of not guilty and request a trial date within the statutory time." Now, he figured. Now he knew what it felt like to be a public defender.
Got your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure. And whatever comes our way, yeah, darling, go make it happen. Take the world in a loving embrace. Fire all of your guns at once and explode into space. Select the true nature's child. We were born to be wild. We can climb so high.
That was Hal Bolan reading Dump Truck by Michael Lee Bowler. And wasn't it a real eye-opener especially to those of us whose knowledge of our justice system is mainly based on watching Law and Order type television shows. The lead character in our story tonight characterizes the folks who work in courts stereotypically. Prosecutors are rigid, judges are pretentious, defense attorneys are poorly dressed, and clients, well, they're usually frightened. Most of us probably never thought about there being such a place as misdemeanor land, filled with fairly uninteresting cases like those involving drunk drivers, illegal aliens, teenage shoplifters, and petty thieves. We probably never thought much about who actually sits on juries as well, or how, because of an overstressed court system, many cases end up being settled when perhaps they should have gone to trial. That's why our author maintains public defenders have become the dump trucks of our justice system. Friends, Michael Lee Bowler is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate from San Diego State. He's been published in numerous publications, including the San Diego Union-Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, the Fresno Bee, and California Lawyer. Thank you, Michael, for that thought-provoking story. Hope you're working on another one for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Joan Newcomb. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.